Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Shari Flanagan, cartoonist, writer, and editor. And we're talking about the new collection of her comics that has just been published, Trots and Bonnie. Shari, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to talk to you as well.
Now, the one thing I have to say about this book, first and foremost, it's about time.
I'm sorry.
I really loved this strip, and I knew it first through National Lampoon. And I have waited for this to be in reprint. Is there a reason why it took so long?
Well, yes. And one thing is that there were copies printed in France that were really nice.
I saw the copy of that. When did they come out?
A hardcover.
Yeah.
It was in like 88, maybe.
Okay.
And yeah, that was done by a friend of mine, Farshid Baruka, who was working at Comics USA, and he did everything. He just said, okay, this is what I want the cover to look like. This is the joke you're going to draw.
Huh.
And he did all the translating, and he sent me a check.
How do they read in French?
Beg your pardon?
So they were in French, obviously, right?
Yeah.
So how do you, did it come across to you? Can you read French?
No. And I have no idea what it actually is saying. For all I know, that he just changed all the dialogue.
He has like a hidden agenda, and he's like sending out all these situationist messages through it. Okay.
Well, now he couldn't do that now because I have Google Translate.
Oh, you're right.
Welcome
to the modern world.
Yeah, thank you.
But I'm so glad these are out. And my reaction when I opened them and started to read the strips is I remembered almost all the strips, maybe not the very first two or three strips. And I remembered the lines. I remember the layout of the panels. And I have to attribute that to your artistic endeavors, both writing it and drawing it. This is a beautiful strip. I love comics. These are beautiful strips even today. I think they've aged well.
And you're a radio guy who's really visual.
I am. Isn't that ironic?
Yes. To a certain extent. Yeah, it's cool. Congratulations.
Thank you. But I am. I taught comics for 30 years at the Worcester Art Museum.
Oh, there you go.
See?
There you go. Yeah. No
and the way. Other thing I realized is how bold these comics are and that today they could not be drawn.
Yeah, but we have Sacha Baron Cohen who makes movies.
You're right.
So,
but still.
When
you deal with younger children, it's like verboten.
Okay, yes, that is the people who think that way don't realize that these are avatars. They're comic characters. They only exist on paper, and they're not real. And they can do anything. I mean, you have to put this into perspective. That where I was coming from in the San Francisco underground comics, and before that, I was working for an underground newspaper, and we were like all about freedom of speech.
Yep.
And freedom of the press. And a lot of people, a lot of men took that in a really violent hatred towards women direction.
I remember it well. I still have my collection of underground comics from that time period.
Yeah. So, and I just went in the direction I wanted to go to. And that was, I described it as at the time as turning over rocks and looking at the stuff that was underneath, because the rocks were these Disney images that we had to grow up with, these images of the perfect child and the perfect teenager. And I just, I definitely was not one. And I was putting out just my reality, really. Everything's verbatim and all, but a lot of it was based on my reality. And there was stuff in there about bullying.
That's right.
Bullying is like a capital B thing now. But when I was doing strips, when my little 13-year-old girl was getting bullied by the kids in junior high, people weren't, that wasn't, they didn't make the Disney movie about that. You know, everybody got along in that perfect world that we were supposed to have.
It was like we were still coming over off of Leave It to Beaver.
Yeah. And it was like, here's this opportunity to do something that's completely alternative to that reality.
It's funny because I just thought they were excellent comics at the time. And now looking back at them, I'm going like, wow, they're really bold. Plus the fact, and this is not a left-handed compliment, but they were effortlessly feminist. I think I'm saying they weren't didactic about it, but they were definitely feminist.
Yeah, I think, I know that people have that impression. And the art style is not necessarily feminine. I mean, I worked really large. So I had an ink line that was being shot down more than 50%.
Oh, wow.
And so that, well, it cleaned up the page a lot to
do
that.
Yeah.
So it made everything look like I had more talent than I did.
Oh, come on. That's not true, Sherry. These are beautifully drawn. They're excellent.
There's a craft. There's a craft to doing it. And it's a craft that can be taught. I've taught classes in how to do pretty much exactly the way I do things.
Yeah, there is the craft of doing it, but then there's also the writing of it. And these strips are just amazing. You know, for the benefit of the audience, let's introduce the major characters. Who are Trots and who is Bonnie?
Trots is the dog in the strip. And my dog of my childhood was named Bonnie. So I named my main character Bonnie. And so Bonnie is ostensibly, anyway, the protagonist of the strip.
But there's a whole other cast of characters. And Bonnie's young. I mean, at one point she gets her period for the first time and is not really sure about what's going on. But she has a close friend who I dearly loved, and that was Pepsi.
Pepsi, for those who think young.
So describe to me the personality of Pepsi.
Pepsi is very confident, overly confident. And I hope you know someone like that. I certainly do. And they're the people that just, you know, can just, they have snap judgment. They can just tell you right away if you're doing something wrong. Usually it's something wrong. It's usually some kind of criticism.
You know what? I always try to think about, where is Pepsi now? Like, what would she be like now, like as an older person? And I just hope she'd be just an extension of who she was as a younger person. She'd be the person I want to hang out with.
Either that or she's probably had a lot of therapy.
Yeah. Maybe.
and it didn't take.
She joined the Symbionese Liberation Army or something like that.
She might have become a therapist until she figured out that they have to listen.
Now, there's a secondary character who, it wasn't until I read this compilation that I really put it all together, who is like the ultimate victim, and that's Elrod. Elrod Stelmach. He has, this poor little younger boy, has so much shit that happens to him in the comic. It's amazing.
Yeah, he's the perfect victim, but, you know, I mean, he's like a one-note character. He has one personality characteristic, and that's being a victim. He's just an innocent victim.
Especially of Pepsi. Pepsi's the one that's always about to do something to him.
Yeah. Well, Pepsi is an active character. She creates a lot of the problems they encounter.
Have you ever revisited them in recent decades?
Or you just
left it behind?
Not, you know, I don't have the Lampoon to contribute to anymore. And that's really, I mean, when people want to know what happened, I didn't voluntarily retire. The Lampoon was sold, I think, more than once.
That's right.
And it was sold because the name had a lot of value because of the films. And they were, I believe the story is that they were required to keep up with publishing the magazine every now and then in order to hold on to the name or have that be valid. So they did keep publishing it, but it wasn't the same thing, and they stopped paying people. That probably is. And the Lampoon used to pay really well, comparatively.
How did you break into that job? And we'll talk about your earlier sort of experiences. But you broke into the Lampoon at sort of the, I would consider the classic era of the magazine. And you even became an editor of National Lampoon for a while.
I did. Hey, I am completely passive about this. I mean, I listen to other people talk about their careers and how hard they try to get stuff into print. Like the people who are working for the New Yorker, they're taking 50 cartoons up to the New Yorker office for 2 years before they get one accepted. So, I don't like to compete.
Okay.
I don't have that. I'm persistent in things like when I pull weeds in my garden, but I am not a persistent person. So,
Are you trying to tell me that you just sort of effortlessly fell into this job?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
I'm not accepting this.
Well, I don't know. I mean, it depends on how far back you want to go, but my parents basically put me into art school because I don't think they thought I was smart enough for college.
Oh, great. Did you have a good experience at art school?
Well, mixed. I learned a lot that I continued to use, and I didn't realize where I was going to use it. And life class, with the nude models, that was always fun. So that was good. And I literally did not understand a lot of the things that the artists who taught there were trying to tell us. I still don't know what they taught me. Because they would just stand up in front of the class and lecture, and then they were like well-known artists, at least in Seattle. So there was that. And then I would just, I would do my thing where I sit in a classroom and just imagine everyone naked or something. So, art school was like that. But it got me my, you could call it a job at the underground paper in Seattle. And that was just starting out. It was not the famous underground paper, Helix. It was another one.
You seem to have like a sort of classic late 60s, early 70s sort of alternative experience. I mean, you did Sky River Funnies for a while.
I ran away from home and took a with my boyfriend in a Volkswagen bus and went across Canada.
It doesn't get better than that.
Yeah, and I stayed in a dorm. I stayed in a frat house at Middlebury College.
Oh my God!
I stayed in a dorm at Harvard. I was like the resident hippie transient.
There's some great photos of you in the book from that time period. You look like the classic, Paisley waif.
Pretty much, although not the farm girl.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not into that at all. And I was painting and drawing and stuff. I mean, I always, I just liked art. So, that was a fun thing to do, and I still do that kind of thing.
You moved to San Francisco in 1971, and you ended up being part of the Air Pirates Collective, which a very famous alternative comic at that time, or head comic, as they used to say, were put out by them.
Yes, and then they were sued for doing it.
By Disney.
Yes.
Yeah, you didn't mess with Disney at that point. They had the best lawyers.
And they still do.
Yeah, they do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I was in love with one of the Air Pirates. And
is that the guy? You have a great section in this book that I highly recommend people don't gloss over, and that's your commentary on all the different strips.
Thank you. I really wanted to put that in there.
I love it. And there are two strips that are sort of related in which you talk about. There's a guy that you fell in love with who was sort of good, bad, but not evil. And then you talk about how you managed to convince him to pose nude for you and how excellent that was.
Oh, that guy.
That guy.
He was very much younger than me, too.
Oh, that's excellent.
22 and he was like 17 or something. Not that I'm a pedophile, but people did that sort of thing.
Yes, they did. A lot.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this isn't the guy that you were running around with in the VW bus?
No, that was... Okay. I actually did an editorial called Dead Boyfriends, and that was that was when... trying to think if I was even 30 when I did that. So I have like a colossal number of dead boyfriends. And so...
Dead from any special reason or something that you did?
No, no. Yeah, right. Now I'm a black widow. I've had three husbands. And one of them...
And they all died?
One of them's still alive.
Okay.
Yeah.
But the other two are dead?
I did not kill them. But I don't think that counts in terms of like... the next guy trusting his luck.
So you're sort of mad, bad, and dangerous to know?
The exact opposite. I'm attracted to mad, bad, and dangerous to know.
That's and it never works out in the end.
Well, apparently not for them.
I just want to mention that Seattle paper that you were, the Seattle Liberation Front's newspaper called Sabat. Is that the one you worked for?
Yes. Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah, that was fun. They let me do almost anything I wanted before the weatherman took over the paper.
Just saying the phrase before the weatherman took over the paper that I worked with, that is such an amazing phrase.
Yeah, well, we were cooperative anarchists, and that first worked on the paper. So, and we were aggregating. You know this from working at the kind of radio station.
Yep.
We were aggregating news that wasn't in the straight press, and that was great fun. I just went through. I have a lot of these old papers, and I went through and photographed a lot of the pages. I realized, like, some of my cartoons are literally coming from the pages of these newspapers.
Wow.
The articles.
Wow.
Yeah, there's a thing about, like, a women's art show.
Right.
Like, very, like, yes, and it's all liberated women.
Well, okay. It's easy to sort of lampoon that age, and I did the same stuff. But I felt that I also got a lot of stuff from that era that I still is close to me today. Is it for you true, or did you just leave it all behind?
No, absolutely. I'm not like Jerry Rubin becoming a stockbroker. People have told me that, oh, we really like you because you're still a hippie. But that means I'm poor.
You still have the attitude, and that's what counts.
Yeah.
Do you still wear paisley?
I would if I had any.
Okay. You don't still have bell bottoms, though, do you? I don't.
Like, no, everybody's wearing bell bottoms now.
So it's not cool anymore.
Not in my mind. But I'm mostly wearing my husband's pants now.
Let's talk about your art. You talk about in the book that you like the art of Charles M. Russell, which is really fascinating because he's a Western artist. And it's sort of a romantic version of the West, too. What attracted you to his art?
That is from probably... I went to the Charlie Russell Museum in Montana when I was 15, I think, and saw a lot of his original paintings. And he did watercolors, which I really... I like using watercolors. And so I was impressed that he used that media. He was painting history. So this was, this was like taking photographs of the things that he painted, only nobody was taking photographs of them. And he was remembering these very dynamic scenes.
Wow.
And saying something with his art. So he's both, you could look at my book and see that I have recorded history there.
Right.
And things. So, and that's one of the things I like, that I feel, that I spent my time doing something worthwhile, because those events, as twisted as they can be, are basically history recorded there. And Charlie Russell did that, and he did it beautifully and perfectly and Sergio Aragonés, excuse me, is an artist who can draw right out of his head in great detail. He can draw cars. He can draw guns.
He was a major artist at MAD.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And he sat in front of me and drew a gun for me. And it was really impressive.
Wow.
Because, you know, I mean, a lot of, I don't know when you draw what you're doing, but a lot of times, if I have to draw a car, usually, now I can fake a car.
You mean like this, and I know a lot of artists do this. There's like a shorthand car that you always go to. Yeah.
Like it has a bumper and headlights.
Yep.
I get confused about the lines of the fenders and the windows, like where the windows should be and things. But there are people who, you know, probably grew up drawing cars and are probably working for an automobile company now. But who can really do that well? And so Charlie Russell was doing that with the horses and cattle and Native Americans and scenes that were happening, you know.
What's amazing reading these Trots and Bonnies now in a single place is, as you just mentioned, it really does track the passing of the years through those decades. And some of them are about sex education, birth control, pap smear, the pill, STDs, or all that information is in there. But there's also stuff about crack. There's stuff about safe sex. I mean, so you actually track very, you know, and you didn't even notice it when you were reading them at the time. But you really track those decades really amazingly.
It's really sick that abortion is still an issue.
I know. I totally agree.
Yeah.
And that's a little scary to realize that we've actually gone backwards.
Yeah.
Sex education is not where it should be.
Yeah. And you were saying that, you know, why didn't this book come out before now? And I'm really happy that it's come out now because all these things are way more important issues than they were, you know, a while ago, a couple of decades ago.
Now, I'm going to ask you about some of your strips and your comments on the strips. There's something about a bidet used by Kathleen Turner.
I did a strip about a bidet.
And in your comments, it says that you knew somebody. Are you dodging me? Who had a bidet that was used by Kathleen Turner?
Yes. Okay, like I told you, I digress a lot, and I am going to, you are going to think I'm totally going off in a tangent.
No, I won't. I won't, I promise.
Okay, so I illustrated a book by Bruce Feirstein,
okay.
Who, it was called Nice Guys Sleep Alone, and he had written a bestseller called A Real Men Don't Eat Quiche.
Right, I remember it.
And so I was hooked up to illustrate this by a really great editor named Gary Luke, who was, I think he was working for maybe Dell Publishing then, I forget the publisher, but, and then he came out here and worked for a publisher out here in Seattle, but a really good editor. Anyway, so I met Bruce Feirstein for the first time at Elaine's in New York, which is like where important people meet and greet. And I met, and so he was there, and Kathleen Turner's husband, who is a real estate developer, I think, was there at our table, and I forget who else was there. And there was a hurricane coming. It was going to hit Long Island. And so Bruce Feirstein was worried about the house that he'd bought with the proceeds from his first book, which was out in this beautiful area in Long Island. He was worried about it being hit by the hurricane. So Kathleen Turner's husband lent us his Maserati to, and I'm like, I'll go. I'll go help you board up your windows when the hurricane is coming. So we got in a Maserati and drove out to Long Island to this house, and that's where we were when the hurricane hit. And it was really kind of weird because all of a sudden you're realizing, like, oh, we're in a hurricane in this house, and I think there was like a hole that we could have like a hole in the floorboards that went down into some sort of crawl space, so we were considering going down there. It turned out that it knocked some trees down, but it didn't do anything really terrible. And but anyway, so it was in Bruce Feirstein's house.
So
he said, I could sell this bidet for $1,000 because Kathleen Turner used it.
Oh, my. And I wonder if there's like a name for that particular kind of erotic fixation.
I don't know, but there's a, what is the initials for things that non-negotiable?
Non-fungible?
Yeah, yeah. So I don't know, maybe.
No. It would have to be like the digital image of it.
Yeah.
And then you're owning that. That's a whole other discussion, by the way.
That could exist somewhere.
I'm going to have to look it up.
Yeah.
We're almost out of time. And I've barely scratched the surface of what I wanted to talk to you about.
My heart, yeah.
Okay, I'm sorry.
It's all right.
I recommend this book really highly. The artwork and the stories are amazing. They're like nothing else people will read today. And they come from that era. And I think they're as great as they were then. Probably more so, more pertinent. Have you gotten feedback or people who are upset with some of these strips?
They're upset about the things that aren't in there.
Oh, and I know specifically I am too.
I'm sorry. Yeah.
You should have put that in there.
Emily Flake mentions.
She does. And here's the funny thing. I know that strip so well that when I first read the book, I thought it was in there. I thought I read it. And then I read Emily Flake's introductory essay, and then I was like, what? And then I read your notes, and I was like, I didn't see it.
It's in the American Bystander. It's in the current issue of the American Bystander.
Thank the gods.
Yeah. And along with seven other strips that aren't in the book. But we talk back and forth about it, and they're like, okay, let's put it, like it's in the introduction, you got to put it in. So they put it in, and they made it the first page in the book.
And you didn't like that.
And I'm like, I cannot take this down to Magnolia's bookstore, my little bookstore in the village here, have them open it up and have that be the first thing they see.
Oh. So yeah. There are some, we're completely out of time and I'm going to have to sign off.
Okay.
So there'll be stories for other times. Okay. My guest tonight has been Sherry Flanagan, cartoonist, writer, and editor. And we've been talking about a brand new collection of her comics from several decades past that is just beautiful and interesting and fun to read. Trots and Bonnie. Sherry, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.